thinking about what it meant to be an ideological conservative, which Hoover was in many, many ways, who made his whole career within kind of the burgeoning federal government and particularly within the New Deal state.
Hello, I'm Jeff Cambaservis from the Niskanen Center. Welcome to the Vital Center podcast, where we try to sort through the problems of the muddled moderate majority of Americans, drawing upon history, biography, and current events. And I'm privileged to be joined today by Beverly Gage. She is a professor of history and American studies at Yale University, and in my estimation, is one of the nation's best historians. She has written for nearly every national media outlet you can think of, and serves on the National Endowment for the Humanities Advisory Board, a position to which she was nominated by President Biden and confirmed by the Senate. But most relevantly to our discussion today, she is the author of the newly released biography of longtime FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. G-Man, J. Edgar Hoover and the Making of the American Century, was named to the New York Times Notable Books of 2022 list as soon as it came out in November, and it is a huge magisterial accomplishment. Congratulations and welcome, Bev.
Thank you, Jeff. It's great to be here, and those were very, very kind words.
Not at all. I feel like opening a bottle of champagne on your behalf. How does it feel to have this book come out after working on it for, how shall I say, a rather long amount of time?
That's right. It feels great. And it feels great for a couple of reasons. I started working on this in 2009, was when I signed the contract with my publisher. And while I wasn't writing it at every moment of those 13 years, nonetheless, J. Edgar Hoover was sort of there in the shadows of my life for that whole time. And so, you know, it feels good to have it out in the world. And I think one of the things that's been really heartening over the past couple of weeks is to see that the world does still, in fact, have a place for big, fat, serious history books that take 13 years to research and write and that run with, you know, footnotes and all of that, more than 800 pages. And sometimes along the way, I wasn't so sure that that would be the case. So it's nice to see that it is.
I would say more than just the world has a place for such books. I think the world needs such books. You know, I'm always a little uneasy when my friends take on books of that length and subjects as big as J. Edgar Hoover. But the benefit is that this is a book with just a tremendous depth of research and reflection to it. And there's a real solidity to it. It's like a well-constructed fortress. And by the end of it, I actually really found myself rethinking my understanding, not just of Hoover, but of the United States in the 20th century.
Well, that's great to hear. That was certainly one of the goals of the book. And it's one of the things that actually attracted me to writing about a figure like Hoover. So Hoover is certainly interesting and influential in his own right. And this is a true biography in the sense that it really does try to grapple with the man as an individual. But he also struck me as kind of an amazing vehicle to tell a bigger story about American politics and particularly about the American federal government and the security state over the course of the practically entire 20th century. Just for listeners who don't actually know the scope of Hoover's career, Hoover was director of the FBI from 1924 under the Coolidge administration to 1972 when he died still in that job under Richard Nixon. And so he was there at the FBI for 48 years, really the core of the American century. And he kind of had his fingers in everything.
And that was a reign that spanned eight presidencies.
That's right. Four Republicans and four Democrats. And of course, one of the questions then becomes, how did he pull that off? And how did he stay in power for so long under such an array of different political figures and administrations?
Yeah. And you point out that for much of that era, he was one of the most famous and most admired Americans who was revered by liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats alike.
Yeah, in our own moment, Hoover is this almost universally reviled figure. There are not many people, I mean, even at the FBI itself, there aren't a whole lot of people who wholeheartedly embrace J. Edgar Hoover, and there are a whole lot of people who really revile him, and I think for very good reasons. But our perception of Hoover as this great villain has made, I think, has made it easy to forget what is one of the central themes of the book, which is that he was enormously popular for most of his career. He was popular, as you said, among Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, and he had this powerful constituency at the grassroots, in Congress, at the White House, and he wasn't this rogue actor, which I think is kind of how we tend to think about him, a guy who sat in back rooms, writing memos, doing things in secret, and strong-arming everyone into submission. But he actually was someone with a huge political base, political constituency, and lots of political support.
But there is this Shakespearean dimension to his career, because as you point out, his reputation did undergo this titanic reversal from one of the most admired Americans to actually one of the most despised in the years really immediately following his death, when revelations of the FBI's abuses and excesses made him the symbol of unaccountable government power. But you point out that Hoover really has a lot of significance for the American century. One of those aspects is that his career encapsulates the development of the American administrative state. He really built the FBI up from what you call a scandal-ridden backwater into the Department of Justice, into a political surveillance force without precedent in American life. But you point out that Hoover's surveillance tools and techniques were known to the presidents and attorneys generals whom he served, and even many members of Congress, and none objected, really, until very late in his career. And more than that, Hoover served so long because people at all levels of American life wanted him there and supported what he was doing.
Yeah, that's right. You know, Hoover came to the FBI director's position in the 1920s when it was a tiny little institution, wasn't yet known as the FBI. And he sort of came into that position as a good government reformer, right? Sort of steeped in all of these traditions that we might describe as progressive traditions, and certainly at the time were described that way. He was a true believer in government professionalism, career government service, scientific methods, nonpartisan identity. And that's really how he made his name during his very, very early career once he was director. And one of the tragedies of his life, I think, is not only that he betrayed many of those principles at many key moments, but that in the end, his legacy and his memory, beginning in the 1970s, is one of our great symbols of why people have kind of lost faith in government, in the administrative state, or, of course, today, the deep state itself.
Mm-hmm. And you do such a good job of pointing out that kind of Janus-like quality of Hoover, how he unites two seemingly opposed qualities. On the one hand, as you say, he was a creature of the Progressive Era and the New Deal, this kind of civil servant who championed professionalism and scientific authority and apolitical expertise. But at the same time, he was also one of the leading avatars of an avenging social conservatism, who embodied conservative values ranging from anti-communism to white supremacy to a highly politicized version of Christianity. He was, as you put it, a conservative state builder throughout the heyday of American liberalism.
In terms of kind of thinking about the historical literature and what a figure like Hoover might contribute beyond, you know, sort of setting the record straight about his own career, those themes of liberalism and conservatism were really interesting to me. And in particular, thinking about what it meant to be an ideological conservative, which Hoover was in many, many ways, which you were just listing off, who made his whole career within kind of the burgeoning federal government and particularly within the New Deal state. How did he do that? Right? That's not a figure we think about a lot. Someone who is a believer in federal power, a believer in the good that the federal government can do for the country at large, and who is also one of the greatest conservative figures and symbols of his age. And so that's really the political puzzle of the book. How did he embody these two traditions at once? How did he put them together? At what points did he stand for one or the other? And I think it is part of the secret to his longevity that so many people could see what they wanted to see in his public self.
Let's step out from the shadow of Hoover for a second. I always like to ask the people who come on these podcasts to tell me something about themselves. So can you tell me where you grew up, where you went to school, maybe what some of your early influences were?
Sure. I grew up outside of Philadelphia. And one of the funny things about writing this book is that I encountered a few moments in my own life or in my own family history that I didn't know about. So one of those is a very famous burglary that takes place in 1971 when some activists in Philadelphia break into an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania. They steal all the files. This is one of the ways that FBI surveillance and infiltration is exposed. But that's actually my hometown.
Oh, wow.
And or the town next to it. And I hadn't known anything about that growing up. So that's where I'm from. I also encountered a couple of funny things about my own family history along the way, which is my mother grew up in Washington, but my parents had kids very late. And so I didn't know my grandfather. But as it turned out, I was going through old yearbooks from George Washington University, which is where Hoover went to school, where Clyde Tolson went to school. And I was going through the Tolson yearbooks, and I happened upon this man whose name I recognized. And so many FBI agents came out of GW that I thought, huh, well, that must be one of them, but I don't remember where. And then I was like, oh no, that's my grandfather. So Tolson and Hoover went into the Bureau of Investigation. My grandfather went on to work in the Bureau of Engraving and Printing in Washington. That's what GW did. It produced people who worked at bureaus. So anyway, that was my growing up around Philadelphia. I was a classical musician as a kid, but then turned to history and American studies as an undergraduate at Yale. It's kind of coincidence that I ended up back there as a professor 10 years after I graduated as an undergrad, but I've been there ever since.
And you got your PhD in history from Columbia University.
I did, yeah. I got my PhD in history from Columbia, and I worked for about 3 years between undergrad and grad school, just being a journalist, freelancing, working in various places.
And who were among your key professors and advisors at Columbia?
Well, I had this sort of all-star team at Columbia. Alan Brinkley was my advisor, great political historian in particular of the New Deal. And he was really pretty influential because when I went to graduate school, I knew that I wanted to study history, but I didn't know what kind of history I really wanted to study. And I certainly wouldn't have said, as I think many people wouldn't have said in the 90s, that I want to study political history. It was sort of a low moment within the historical profession for the study of political history. Alan Brinkley was one of the people who really did describe himself that way. And so it was during my time at Columbia that I not only began to think, oh, actually, you know, kind of pretty formal political history is interesting. And it was becoming just a much more vibrant field than it had been. So he was my advisor. I also worked with Eric Foner, was on my committee, Ken Jackson, the great historian of New York, Foner, of course, a historian of the Civil War and Reconstruction. And I worked with Simon Schama as well. And he was interesting. He taught a class called Writing History Beyond the Academy that was thinking about ways of writing history that would not only have a lot of scholarly rigor to them, but that would also speak to a broader public audience. And that was really valuable to have the opportunity to do that while in graduate school.
I recently interviewed Nicole Hemmer for the podcast, and she also was an Alan Brinkley student. And we talked a lot about how Alan, who sadly is no longer with us, was really one of the people most responsible for pointing out that the historical profession had utterly neglected the study of conservatives during the 20th century. then, of course, there followed a tsunami of scholarship on conservatism.
Yeah, it's been a really fascinating thing to watch. I actually was having dinner with Nikki Hemmer last night. Here at a workshop to do a workshop at Yale that I run with Elizabeth Hinton, who actually is another product of the Columbia History Graduate Program, but is now a professor with me at Yale. And when I started graduate school, it was the moment that Brinkley wrote this famous essay that said, you know, historians have neglected conservatives, and this is sort of coming out of the Reagan years, when it seemed clear to everyone that you might really want to think more seriously about conservatives and the history of conservatism. And it's been fascinating to watch that field explode such that, you know, 20 years later, another Brinkley student, Kim Phillips Fine, would write another overview essay saying, is this all played out now? Are we done with this? And my answer in the Hoover book is no, that actually thinking about, you know, conservatives and their relationship with state power is really important, actually is very underwritten. And, you know, because I think we have an idea of the conservative movement in particular as it started in the 50s and 60s as being somehow anti-federal and anti-statist, we've missed out on these really important conservative figures like Hoover, who were within the state itself.
Yeah, you do point out that most of the conservatives that scholars have written about have been politicians or provocateurs of some kind. And there has been relatively less attention to conservative state builders and exercisers of real power in the system, which I think is one of the great contributions of your book. But before we get back to Hoover, I cannot resist pointing out that in the 2007 to 2008 academic year, you were on a sabbatical leave, and I came up to Yale to teach some of your classes. And I particularly remember that I taught the sort of big lecture on American political history since 1945 that I myself had sat through when John Blum, the legendary history professor, was teaching it. And I remember thinking, how on earth did Blum actually go into such detail about particular episodes of government and legislative history? And then I thought, well, number one, Blum didn't actually deal with conservatives at all, because most historians didn't in those days. And number two, that was actually 20 years ago, and there's been a lot more history since then. And nowadays, that period, you know, would be almost all but unteachable, except in broad outlines, I would imagine.
Yeah, and I actually, in part because the students who are now in college were all born in the 21st century.
Shocking.
And have no living memory of the 20th century at all. It used to be we split the course in 1945, but I've smashed it all together into one semester. So I now teach a class called The American Century that tries to get through the entire 20th century in one semester, and then at least give hints of places that students could go deeper from there.
Very ambitious.
I should note, I'm teaching a seminar on liberalism and conservatism this semester, and we read The Guardians.
Oh, that's so very kind of you.
We have assigned the first great Jeff Kaba Service book.
You are kind to have assigned that. And actually, you know, there were a number of points in Kingman Brewster's career that actually made me think about while I was reading your book, because there actually was certain overlaps, which we may get to. So just let's back up. How did you decide that you wanted to write about J. Edgar Hoover?
I encountered Hoover as a historical character, aside from, you know, kind of the household name, popular image, when I was writing my last book, which was a book about a 1920 bomb attack on Wall Street, a terrorist attack suspected at the time, and I think rightly, of being an anarchist attack. And it was a big event. It killed almost 40 people. It shut down the financial markets, and it was seen as this kind of great blow in the struggle between anti-capitalist radicals of the late 19th and early 20th century and, you know, the new world of Wall Street that was emerging in that moment.
Let me parenthetically add that that was your great 2009 book, The Day Wall Street Exploded, A Story of America in Its First Age of Terror. And I had to laugh while reading the Hoover book because there's a paragraph on page 88 that refers to that. And there is your book lurking behind that paragraph, much as there are other huge books lurking behind every paragraph in the Hoover biography. But yes, go ahead.
It's true. The nature of this biography is that, you know, every paragraph, every incident, there's a whole historical literature that is devoted to that alone. So there's a lot of primary research, but there's a lot of synthesis too that I was doing. And some of that synthesis was, in fact, my own last book, which, as you say, got reduced to a paragraph in this book. But it is, in fact, the way that I began to get interested in Hoover, and that was for a couple of reasons. One was that was a very earlier period, and it was before he became bureau director, but he was there investigating that bombing and conducting campaigns against political radicals in 1919 and 1920 as head of this little experiment in the Justice Department called the Radical Division, which really was the first federal peacetime surveillance program aimed at revolutionaries, left-wing radicals. Most famously, he helped to orchestrate the Palmer deportation raids of those years. So I encountered him there as a very young man, and two things struck me. One was that so many of the ideas that he was going to carry on and that he was still going to be talking about, you know, in the 60s and 70s really had their origin in this much earlier period. And that was fascinating for him, but it also was an interesting way of kind of reperiodizing some of the 20th century, moving some of that back in time. And then the second was that I started reading the literature about Hoover and found that there were good books, but some of them were already becoming dated. There was lots of new material coming out. And then particularly there were new fields of historical inquiry that seemed incredibly useful to understanding him. We were talking about conservatism as a field. That was one. Gay and lesbian history was another. All of the new studies of the state, state building, American political development. You know, most of the literature on Hoover kind of came out in the late 80s and early 90s. So it just seemed like a great moment for a rethinking and a kind of big story.
Yeah, this is the first major biography of Hoover to appear in, I think, 30 years. And I would actually encourage readers of your book to press on to the end, where there's a lovely note on sources, just a beautiful historical essay. And you say of Hoover that there is at once too much material and too little. Care to expand on that?
That's right. I was very insistent with my publisher that we needed a note on sources that would both describe a little bit of the research and then also talk about some of the historical literature that was informing my own work, since I drew on the work of so many people who had kind of touched the world of J. Edgar Hoover in one way or another. But the primary sources themselves were really interesting. On the one hand, you know, he's the head of this massive bureaucracy for decade after decade after decade, and he was a very devoted paperwork guy. So, you know, the FBI just produced unbelievable amounts of paper, reports, all of this. So there's this incredible wealth of material there, some of which is, you know, newly released either through FOIA or through other processes. And I can talk about those files as well.
Though you also mentioned painful levels of redaction.
Well, that's the other part of the story, is that so many of the things that you want to know, you can't know or don't know, because either records have been destroyed, but more, I think, significantly, we still have pretty heavy levels of redaction on many files. And so, yeah, it's a funny combination of having way too much and then not nearly enough.
Yeah, there is so much to talk about when one talks about Hoover. We cannot deal with everything, but I just want to touch on a few things. He was born in Washington, D.C., on New Year's Day, 1895, and he lived his entire life in Washington, D.C., and he's buried in the Congressional Cemetery here, near his parents, the sister he never met, and Claude Tolson, his number two at the FBI, of whom we'll talk about more. You refer at one point to an aspect of his ancestry, which is his, what did you call it? His Swiss-bred devotion to cleanliness and order. And you also found some family scandals of which previous biographers had been unaware.
That's right. A lot of the story of Hoover's family and childhood had been a story about a kind of idyllic upbringing. This was something that Hoover himself promoted and sold. And so when I began to be able to use new genealogical databases and new just kind of newspaper aggregation databases and search around for some of his family history, I found some really surprising things. Suicides, murders, you know, all sorts of pieces of the story that I think really complicate his upbringing and complicate his consciousness, even though this is not in any way an attempt at a psychobiography. And one of the pieces, as you say, that is very interesting to me as well about Hoover is the fact that he's such a pure creature of Washington, D.C. He's born there in 1895. He's born to a family that already has a history of government service, which is pretty unusual in the late 19th century. I mean, the federal government isn't doing very much then, but he's born right on Capitol Hill. He lives in D.C. his entire life. He dies in D.C. And because he's a D.C. resident during those years, he never votes. He never joins a political party. And so, you know, he is like a living, breathing embodiment of this kind of government, nonpartisan, very Washington tradition that's very small when he's born and is just this massive monolith by the time he dies.
You know, I know it's said of D.C. that it's the northernmost city of the South. JFK's witticism was that it's a city that combines northern charm with southern efficiency. But I didn't really identify Hoover as a southerner. And yet I noticed that when he went to George Washington University, he was a member of the Kappa Alpha fraternity, founded in 1865 to honor Robert E. Lee and sort of the uber Confederate fraternity, really, in American history. And that was an element that you kept coming back to again and again.
Yeah, I think the southernness of Washington itself is really important for someone like Hoover. You know, and this period in the late 19th and early 20th century when he is growing up is a period in which Washington, which is a multiracial city, is very self-consciously segregating. And you're getting much firmer divisions between white and black. Federal employment itself is segregating in new ways. And so, you know, purely in terms of when he's born and where he's born, he's kind of coming of age in a segregationist tradition. And then he goes to college at George Washington University and joins this fraternity, Kappa Alpha. And I had known from other books that Kappa Alpha, he was very loyal to. He drew a lot of his first generation of FBI officials, both out of GW and Kappa Alpha. But when I began to look into what Kappa Alpha was, I was pretty stunned. So it was this explicitly Southern, exclusively Southern fraternity, had been created in the aftermath of the Civil War, really to carry on the lost cause of the White South. And by the time Hoover joined it, it was sort of a power center for conservative segregationist Southern Democrats in Washington. So you have lots of conservative Southerners who are members of the fraternity or kind of around in the alumni chapter. Probably the most famous Kappa Alpha of Hoover's day from a slightly earlier generation was a guy named Thomas Dixon, who was a novelist who wrote the novels upon which Birth of a Nation, the famously racist film, came out in 1915, was based. And those were Hoover's college years. And so he is steeped in the culture of Kappa Alpha. He maintains those ties for all of his life. He remains quite closely tied to his fraternity and to the ideas that he really learned to articulate during those early years.
Yes, he absolutely internalizes those Southern values of white supremacy and order and virtue and the white Southern Christian gentleman's way of life. And it's significant, you know, that just as Wilson resegregated the Washington bureaucracy when he was president, Hoover resegregated the FBI when he became its director as well.
That's right. And Hoover resisted many calls and many pressure campaigns over the course of his career, particularly to hire more Black agents. And Hoover's ability to create the agent core in the way that he wanted, with men, white men, who represented his values, his background, is really one of the most extraordinary accomplishments, particularly of his early career. And he does two things. One is that he is very careful to keep his agents outside of the civil service, kind of by a quirk of the way the bureaucracy was developing. They weren't under civil service rules. And Hoover is adamant that he does not want to have to select his agents from a pool of qualified civil service applicants. He wants to be able to choose men who really are a lot like him, relatively conservative. Our image of the FBI agent or the G-man, the government man, which is what they become known as in the 30s, of this kind of tall white guy in his suit with his spit shine shoes and his hat. I think it's still most people's image of an FBI agent.
You refer to the sheer monotony of their outlook and background.
Exactly. And that was very deliberate and very carefully built.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Hoover really does come of age with the administrative state, and it's a quirk of history that he comes into government at just about the time that the Great War, World War I, is really reshaping government and making it a very different force in American life.
It's interesting to think, you know, had J. Edgar Hoover graduated from law school in some year other than 1917, would we have had a different course of history? Would he have had a different course of history? But he did not. He graduated in 1917, just as the U.S. was entering the war. Instead of signing up to go fight, he enters the Justice Department in that moment, in part because the Justice Department is kind of desperate for smart young lawyers who can help to administer all the things that are being assigned to it in this moment of the war. Hoover's first job is actually something that we don't think about much, but was interning Germans during the war. The United States had a pretty substantive program of internment aimed at, you know, non-naturalized Germans who were living in the U.S., who were for one reason or another deemed dangerous. You know, the head of the Boston Symphony Orchestra was interned in the First World War. At any rate, he happens to enter government at the moment when these new forms of surveillance, of detention, of national security are just being born, and he learns them, and it turns out he's really, really good at them, at least for the purposes that his bosses want.
Yeah, he actually also worked at the Library of Congress and kind of brings the skill and art of card making and filing with him to the FBI as well.
Yeah, his first government job is at the Library of Congress, and it's at the moment when these library classification systems that are very familiar to us, the Dewey Decimal System, but the Library of Congress system is being invented. And so he's this kind of like cutting edge information technology figure for his age.
Mm-hmm. You know, something that really comes out about Hoover in the time of the Palmer raids and the first Red Scare is his lack of curiosity about what it is that drives radicals and his inability to distinguish between subversives who might actually be bent on causing the country harm and just free thinkers like Harlem Renaissance writers and artists.
That remains true his whole career. So on the one hand, you know, there is Hoover in the First World War and the Red Scare that follows, rising very fast through the Justice Department as a very young man. He's still in his early 20s. He is styling himself as the country's first great expert on communism because the Bolshevik Revolution has just happened in Russia. You get a couple of communist parties formed in the United States in 1919. And Hoover writes the first substantive legal governmental briefs on, you know, who are these folks? What are they up to? And it becomes the cause of his life. On the other hand, he actually, from that moment through the end of his life, doesn't really understand A, what attracts people to radical movements, B, how to distinguish between, you know, say, a violent revolutionary and someone who like is just reading Lenin in a book group. And or even in that moment, as well as later, you know, liberals and civil libertarians who think that communists have a right to speak their mind like anyone else. Everyone's just kind of lumped in together as suspect.
And this actually seems allied to his inability to understand crime as anything other than a moral failing, his complete resistance to any possible structural explanations such as poverty or discrimination.
Yeah, there are a few moments in his career where under the Roosevelt administration or the Johnson administration, the pressure to articulate some kind of structural understanding of crime is significant enough that Hoover will gesture in that direction. But fundamentally, what he stands for is the idea that crime is an individual moral failing, and a lot of his cultural conservatism, as he's articulating it throughout his whole career, is really centered around that question. He spends lots of time, you know, lecturing American mothers for not attending to their children well enough, for doing things like playing bridge and drinking alcohol rather than tending to their children at every moment. And, you know, if you are not, your children are going to grow up to be terrible, terrible criminals. Advocating that everybody go to Sunday school, these sorts of things that you think, why is the director of the FBI, you know, giving this long speech about Sunday school? But those themes, the centrality of religious faith, of morality, of a kind of public religiosity, are really central to how he thinks about crime as well as communism.
And he imposes these same values on the FBI in kind of a cultish way, in that the agents have to not just have a certain appearance and dress a certain way, they have to behave according to Hoover's code of moral conduct. And there are even some creepy details, like he keeps the windows open in the offices during the winter so that no one can be seen to be sleeping or slothful on the job.
He was an incredibly rigid boss in a whole variety of ways. First of all, in who he hired, right? Again, particularly in the agent corps, there was a very particular type of man he wanted. And then once you were in, you had a raft of rules to abide by. So office culture, he was both a germaphobe and a kind of neat freak. And so particularly in the 20s and 30s, when he has lots of time to attend to such things, he's writing these kind of operatic memos about how galoshes have been left out. You know? And what if the attorney general walked through our bureau and saw those galoshes? That what would he think? You know, and if you can't even put your shoes and your snacks in the right place, what does that say about the possibility that you will ever be able to, you know, fight crime or whatever it might be? So he's very rigid in a wide variety of ways, and there are moments where sometimes his employees attempt to push back a little bit, they fail utterly. One of my favorite is an extraordinarily repressed attempt by members of his fingerprint division to unionize in the 1930s. At the moment, you know, when unions are a hot thing, and Hoover just crushes them.
And yet, behind this rigid facade, there is another side of Hoover. Tell us about Claude Tolson.
Right. So one of the things that happens over the course of being a biographer is that you do find a human side, even to a man like J. Edgar Hoover. And one of the places that really came out was in his relationship with Clyde Tolson, who was, for most of his career, his number two at the FBI. So they worked very, very closely together. But more than that, was really his social partner for more than four decades. They traveled together. They went to nightclubs together. They ate all of their meals together. And they were a pretty widely recognized social couple in Washington, in New York. You know, if you invited Edgar to dinner, you invited Clyde. And when they sent a thank you note, it was, you know, Clyde and I had such a wonderful time. Thanks so much. So they really functioned as this couple in a very open and very widely accepted way. Of course, the question then becomes, what kind of couple were they? And of course, we don't really know what they were doing in the privacy of their respective bedrooms. There are, of course, famous stories about this, but a lot of them are not based on anything that historians would recognize as kind of firm evidence. Some of the evidence that I really loved, and I hope you saw the hardback version of the book rather than the galley, because it had the photo inserts, and Hoover kept this kind of extraordinary personal photo collection, a lot of which is of his vacations with Tolson in the 30s and 40s, and they're incredibly intimate and often very erotic photos. And I was happy to be able to, you know, print some of those and put them out into the world.
Those photos also appear in the Kindle edition. People would be glad to know.
Good.
You know, Jamie Kirchick was on my podcast a while ago, and he wrote Secret City, another New York Times notable book this year, in which he concluded that there's no way of knowing whether Hoover and Tolson were in fact a gay couple. And yet I also agree with your argument that understanding Hoover as a gay man is the most straightforward explanation for the life he chose.
Right. We know a lot of pretty basic things. One is that he had no interest in women. He didn't date women. The moment after his mother dies, there's a brief flurry in which people say, because he's been living with his mother his whole adult life, there's a brief flurry of interest in whether he will now start dating women and get married. And that doesn't go anywhere. It's clearly just kind of PR fluff. He and Tolson also clearly really did love and care for each other in a pretty deep way. You see glimmers of this in their notes to each other, in the photographs, and just in the fact that they spent their whole lives together, which is a lot more than a lot of people can say, right? They had a relationship that lasted for more than 40 years. And one of the more touching moments to me, and this is the final image of the book, is that when Hoover dies in 1972, you know, big official funeral, but when he's brought to Congressional Cemetery and there's a flag over his casket, the honor guard folds the flag and they hand that flag to Clyde Tolson in a kind of gesture of respect of some sort for the relationship they had.
And Tolson would later be buried right nearby Hoover's grave as well.
Right.
Yeah, one wonders in a later era if that might not have been as regarded as the perfect couple who lived an office life together as well as a personal life together, because Tolson actually was Hoover's number two throughout this entire period as well.
Exactly. And they often said that they spent so much time together. Of course, they roundly denied that they were gay, and not only denied that they were gay, were very active in the policing of and purging of other gay federal employees, which was federal policy in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, that you, if you were found to be homosexual, you were expelled from federal employment. So the FBI is enforcing that, and Hoover is also very actively policing rumors about his own homosexuality, which were there. But, you know, if you were at a cocktail party in Washington and said to the wrong person, "Hey, I've heard this thing about the FBI director," you might in fact get an FBI agent showing up on your doorstep a few days later saying, you know, "You should not say such scurrilous and terrible things about our very respectable FBI director." So, you know, he actively policed his own image and the rumors about him.
Yeah, that is one of the more sinister aspects of the book that surfaces. It's a paradox of Hoover that you point out that although he is identified as a conservative, and rightly so, the two presidents who did the most to make the FBI and Hoover personally were FDR and Lyndon Baines Johnson, both Democrats, liberal Democrats at that. And FDR did that largely through enabling the FBI to change to meet the threat of the crime wave of the 1930s, but then also to, in 1936, charge the FBI with beginning to investigate domestic fascism and communism. And that is really the power that allowed Hoover to grow and expand the FBI.
FDR liked Hoover, thought he was doing a good job. FDR was not much of a civil libertarian. And so it really is Franklin Roosevelt that gives the FBI, first of all, vastly expanded criminal law enforcement powers. FBI agents don't consistently carry guns until the mid-1930s, and it's a kind of big transformation that they go through from being kind of white-collar investigators to actually then needing to be gun-toting G-men. And it's also Franklin Roosevelt who, as you said, gives them entree back into political surveillance and then massively expands the FBI's size and Hoover's power during the war. So the FBI quadruples in size during the Second World War as the domestic police force, basically.
And weirdly, Hoover can appear as a liberal in this administration in the sense that he is against the detention of Japanese American citizens. And he is also forming some alliances with the ACLU, his former critics, and even the NAACP during this time.
Yeah, in the 40s, it would be hard to think of Hoover as being, you know, anything other than, if not quite a liberal, certainly a New Dealer. And he was always pretty good at reading the political winds. And so he's trying to stay pretty close to both what the president wants and where he thinks, you know, kind of the political consensus of the moment might be, and to placate his historic critics. And so there are these funny moments of collaboration with, as you say, the ACLU, with the NAACP, particularly around lynching campaigns. And one of Hoover's, I think, most cherished values and genuinely was a kind of contempt for and hostility to vigilantism of any sort. And so even if, you know, in some way he might have sympathized with the cause of the White South, broadly conceived, and he certainly did, he had very little patience for groups like the Ku Klux Klan, who, A, sought to use extra legal violence to carry out their political aims, or B, spent a lot of time thumbing their nose at federal law enforcement authority. And so he engaged in campaigns against lynchers, against the Ku Klux Klan, and those were important parts of his identity and his legacy.
Although, as you point out, he never went after right-wing forces with the enthusiasm and passion that he did going after the communists and left-wing groups.
Right. That's what he really cared about, was crushing communism, and not even, you know, as just a kind of espionage threat or the Communist Party itself. But he believed his whole life that he was engaged in this grand existential struggle with communism as a national security issue, but also as a cultural force, as an assault on the American way of life, on American freedom, etc. And that's the thing that made, I think, his worldview really make sense.
So Hoover really rises to become one of the New Deal elite during this time. There's that heartwarming anecdote where FDR's assistant Harry Hopkins asks Hoover to wiretap his wife, as one does. But you then point out that with the end of the war, Hoover began to use his state power to promote and enforce his conservative beliefs in order and hierarchy, religiosity, racial segregation, and anti-communism as the bedrock of American life. And really beginning in the 1940s, you say he was the single most important architect of the Red Scare.
Yeah, during the first half of his career as FBI director, you know, he's kind of building his bureaucracy, he's making his name, but he's, in the grand scheme of things, relatively junior. And it's only in the 40s, particularly the late 40s, that he begins to really exercise the kind of autonomous power that we think of him as having. And a lot of that comes through the Red Scare of that era. One of the most interesting relationships for me and most surprising was to look at Hoover and Joseph McCarthy. We tend to, I think of them as basically the same kind of guy, right? Mm. Operatically anti-communist, very aggressive. But in the McCarthy era, both Hoover himself and many other people see them as very different, that McCarthy is kind of the public demagogue, the one who's willing to play sort of fast and loose with the facts. And Hoover is the statesman, the bureaucrat, the observer of limits and facts. We know now that some of that isn't true, but Hoover was the much more serious institution builder, and he really built the apparatus of the Red Scare. And in that sense, McCarthy was just kind of a showman who came and went.
Yeah, Ellen Schrecker, in a book about 20 years ago, Many Are the Crimes, did also conclude that Hooverism was ultimately more important than McCarthyism. But I think he put it really sharply, which is that McCarthy never had Hoover's political skills or his interest in the slow, difficult work of institution building, which meant that McCarthyism ultimately was a surface phenomenon, whereas Hooverism came first, lasted longer, and mattered more.
Well said, Jeff.
Very well indeed. And of course, you know, again, there's an irony that Hoover, as someone who probably was a gay man, also kicked off the Lavender Scare, which began with but then outlasted the Red Scare and also resulted in a lot of firings from government positions and really damaged and destroyed lives.
That's right. Simultaneous with the Red Scare is the Lavender Scare. And you know, the FBI didn't make the policy exactly that civil service employees, in particular federal employees who are found to be gay, would be purged from federal employment, but it really became the chief enforcement and investigative mechanism for those inquiries. And so in the end, Hoover and the Bureau were responsible for getting, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people, certainly brought up for hearings, in many cases fired, and that went on for a very long time.
Yeah, it's also in the late 50s under Eisenhower's presidency that COINTELPRO starts. And this, of course, will become one of the most damaging aspects of Hoover's legacy. But you pointed out that it started small. Can you tell us about its creation?
I think today, COINTELPRO is probably the most famous and most notorious of the kind of abusive programs of the Hoover era. So the word stands for counterintelligence program. And what the FBI meant by counterintelligence was not just surveillance of political groups it didn't like, but also active disruptive measures aimed at destabilizing organizations, discrediting leaders, you know, anonymous letters, fake pamphlets, sending your informants in to make the meetings really long and boring was a big FBI strategy. And for anyone who's tried to do, you know, social movement organizing of one sort or another, you know that that in fact does kill organizations if you've got people in the room who are just asking dumb questions and it's going on too long. So they have this vast array of techniques that were aimed at these kinds of disruptive measures. Today, we associate COINTELPRO and those techniques with the FBI's campaigns against people like Martin Luther King, the civil rights movement, the New Left, the anti-war movement, and that was all true. But there are a couple of things about COINTELPRO that I think changed that perception a little bit. One, as you say, it started in the 50s. It started pretty small, and it started as a program specifically aimed at the Communist Party. The FBI was worried that its old techniques of prosecuting people or conducting surveillance were becoming more restricted by the Supreme Court, not supported by public opinion. So they started this secret program instead. And the other was that though most of this was aimed at the left, there was one program in particular, which was COINTELPRO White Hate, that was aimed at white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups. And they used the same techniques pretty effectively, actually, and often at the very same moment that the FBI is trying to target Martin Luther King, drive him out of public life, destabilize the civil rights movement. They're doing exactly the same thing to the Ku Klux Klan.
You know, one of the significant aspects of your book is that this is the first Hoover biography that uses the Venona files and also the Operation Solo files. Can you tell us about those?
Those were two of the FBI's kind of, as they would have described it, great triumphs in thinking about Soviet espionage. So Venona was a decryption program, very secret, that was started by the Army, and then the FBI stepped in which they had all these cables from the war that turned out to be the Soviets talking with themselves about all of the spies they had in the United States. And so they began to decrypt a lot of this in the late 40s and early 50s. It's the program that led them to figures like Julius Rosenberg, although it was all top secret in that moment. Venona turns out to be sort of a mixed bag. It was infiltrated. The famous British Soviet operative, Kim Philby, ended up basically telling the Soviets everything that the FBI knew. It wasn't as effective as they thought that it was, but they thought it was a great success in that moment. And then Operation Solo was a really incredible story. And these are amazing files in which the FBI had both the international representative of the American Communist Party and the secret courier of Soviet money to the American Communist Party, both on its own payroll. And they spent the late 50s, really up through the 80s, kind of telling the FBI everything that they were up to. And they were going around the world meeting with people like Mao and Fidel Castro. And the FBI has very elaborate charts of the millions of dollars that the Soviet Union is sending to prop up the Communist Party.
I found those descriptions utterly fascinating. You know, you point out that the 50s was really Hoover's zenith, because on the one hand, conservatives just love how he is willing to use state power in support of the American way of life. At the same time, liberals appreciate that he actually is a counterweight to the irresponsibility and chaos of Joe McCarthy. And in a weird way, Hoover also provides some ballast to the responsible conservatives, like Bill Buckley in the National Review, against the extremists when it came to marginalize the John Birch Society and some of these other really conspiratorially minded anti-communist groups, even though they thought of Hoover as virtually their patron saint. But you also point out that this balance ultimately collapses in the 1960s, both as the issue of communism fades and as race and civil rights really come to the fore and divide the country. But I got to say, one of the funniest and in some ways most telling parts of the book is reading about the conflicts that Hoover had with his new boss, Robert F. Kennedy, during the Kennedy administration, and the way in which how Kennedy kind of tormented Hoover really showed just how rigid and ossified Hoover's FBI had become, but also the real drawbacks of his version of order for America was.
The Kennedy years are, they basically are driving Hoover crazy. So that is probably the most fractious relationship that he had with any presidential administration. Although I have to say, I ended up during those years having a little bit of sympathy for Hoover. So first of all, he's getting old, and here you've got this new generation coming into power. But, you know, he's a little skeptical of the idea that the president should be able to appoint his, what was Robert Kennedy, 35 years old or something when he became attorney general. And Hoover was sort of like, I don't think you should be able to do that. And this guy doesn't, you know, he seems a little bit more sure of himself than maybe his actual skills and background would suggest. So there's a generational conflict. There's a conflict of sensibility. There is an institutional conflict over what the real purpose of the FBI is around things like organized crime and civil rights. And then there is, you know, what was the kind of worst thing that you could do, which is a conflict because Robert Kennedy in particular was criticizing the FBI as having become slow and ossified, particularly around organized crime, not really having its act together, and nothing earned you Hoover's enmity. But it's pretty funny stuff because they really are just vicious about each other. And they're stylistically so different. I mean, Hoover just would get so angry when Robert Kennedy would take off his tie. It's just like total disrespect for the work of government to walk around in your shirt sleeves. And so there are all these shirt sleeves memos in which he's really quite upset about this.
And RFK actually installs a buzzer from which he can summon Hoover to his office, which Hoover did not like at all.
That's right. He was rightly saying, you know, you might think that you're everyone's boss, Edgar, but actually the Attorney General is the boss of the FBI director, and you answer to me, I don't answer to you, which actually turned out not to be true in the end, but he's not very good at this. And in fact, he does end up answering to Hoover more than Hoover answers to him.
You know, something that you raised in your book, which I hadn't thought much about, is that a lot of Hoover's FBI agents go on to play important roles in the conservative movement. Dan Smoot, who became kind of an early media mogul, was a former agent. So was W. Cleon Skousen, who wrote a lot of the books that were critical to the John Birch Society. Senator Thomas Dodd was actually one of the former agents, and Nixon had applied to be an agent but didn't actually get through. Actually, you know, at Yale University in the early 60s, then-President Whitney Griswold hired John Powell to be the dean of security, and Powell started keeping files on supposedly subversive tendencies of individual students and faculty members, which he then sent on to the FBI. And, you know, although there's not time to get into all of the difficulties that the FBI experienced and the contradictions that Hoover experienced in confronting the Jim Crow segregation and violence against the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, I was really interested to see that Lori Pritchett, the sheriff in Albany, Georgia, was also a former FBI agent. And he's actually the one who seemed to actually use Hoover's ideas of professionalism in a way to effectively repress the civil rights movement, because Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Committee actually spent a whole year in Albany trying to integrate it. And Pritchett frustrated their plans, because instead of giving them the spectacle of violence that could be captured on television and move the hearts and minds of viewers around the country, he would just very blandly arrest the protesters. He would pray with them. He actually would claim for himself the mantle of passive resistance in this case. And it was, in some ways, this is what Martin Luther King, I think, is writing about when he writes Letter from a Birmingham Jail. This is the face of white moderation that wants order and is prepared to let segregation go on forever as long as it doesn't provide something really inconvenient or damaging. And he needs not a Pritchett, but a sort of dumb anti-Hoover type like Bull Connor in Birmingham to actually have his movement succeed.
Yeah, those two pieces that you mentioned, the ex-agents, and then also this kind of hidden history of FBI influence on Southern policing during the heyday of the civil rights movement, were both really fascinating to me. I think if I were to continue writing about such a thing, I'm going to pause, I think, after these 13 years. But those are two areas that I think are really ready for deeper historical work and explanation. You know, the ex-agents, they're sort of everywhere. They're within law enforcement. They're running their own private security firms. They're becoming conservative activists. And it's just a fascinating story about, you know, how the state creates all of these private actors who are, in fact, trained by Hoover, given legitimacy by him, get their skills from him. And then Lori Pritchett is a really great character. I think he was not an ex-agent, but had gone through the FBI Academy.
That's right.
Which
that's
is right. The FBI's training ground for local police officials, and was a really important source of kind of Hoover spreading his ideas into law enforcement, which mostly happens at the local level in the United States. And he's a fascinating strategist. And one of the reasons that King goes to Birmingham is he's like, we really need, you know, a bully like Bull Connor, who is going to create a violent spectacle that will get public attention. And in fact, Bull Connor had his own history of refusing to send Birmingham policemen to the FBI Academy because he didn't want that kind of professionalizing, kind of moderating force. So there's a whole kind of hidden history of police politics within all of these organizations.
I'm not encouraging you to write a sequel, but I am going to say that it really struck me that Hoover was such a significant figure through which to view the 1960s, because the 60s witnesses, on the one hand, the enormous increase in crime that continues through the 1990s and affects so much of American politics and life during that time. And at the same time, you also have the rise of these protest movements, not just the civil rights movement, but also the anti-war movement, the student movement, and the more extreme forms of protest, such as the Black Panthers. And Hoover, you point out, unlike the various conservative commentators who just denounced these developments, actually had the power to contain, to manipulate, to infiltrate, and ultimately to destroy entire organizations and movements. And although I don't have a great deal of sympathy for the Black Panthers, I think there's no doubt that Hoover through his actions against groups like that, helped really to destroy a lot of Americans' faith in government.
Yeah, and that is the key, I think, to thinking about Hoover, is that, first of all, during that period, as you say, he really had an enormous amount of independent power and secret power that he could use to kind of enforce his vision of who was legitimate and who was illegitimate within the big sprawl of American democracy. And he did that quite actively. As a result, there's practically nothing that happens in the 1960s that you can understand in a deep way without thinking about the role of the FBI. So any social movement, any organization that is engaged in political activity during that period, whether you're talking about nonviolent protest or you're talking about violent protest or even more conventional forms of politics, you know, the FBI is there. One great example is Lyndon Johnson getting a special squad of FBI agents to surveil and infiltrate and report back to him about civil rights activists at the 1964 Democratic Convention. And so everything that's happening is being influenced by Hoover in particular, by the FBI. And I think it's worth thinking about whether the fate of the movements of the 60s would have been different if you'd had a different man in power. And I think it's the best case for the idea that, you know, a more restrained FBI director might have produced a very different set of political fates in the 1960s.
You know, by the time of Hoover's death in 1972, a lot of people seem to feel that he's there because he has dirty secrets on everyone who matters in politics and American life. And that's how he's able to maintain his position of power. And you mostly, I think, show that that's not true, that in fact, there are actually on reasons of Hoover's popularity with the public and also his skill at bureaucratic manipulation and just sheer political relations that keep him in power for all that time. But you do say that there actually were secret files that Hoover kept locked up in his office. Tell us about those.
Right. Our image is that this is the sole source of Hoover's power. And I think that is not true. But it is certainly true that his secret files were a source of his power. And he did have lots of information on major political figures, on other figures prominent in public life. And some of those were just knowledge of what people had asked the FBI to do. So in the Nixon administration, Nixon and Hoover had been great friends for a long time. They get into a lot of conflicts when Nixon is president. Nixon actually wants to ease Hoover out, but feels that he can't do it for a couple of different reasons, all of which I think are important. One is that Hoover is still pretty popular, especially among conservatives, that Nixon feels like he really needs to keep in his camp. And so there's that piece. They have this long history together. But Hoover has also, you know, set up a series of wiretaps at the behest of Nixon and Henry Kissinger on members of the White House staff, on members of the press. He's been keeping those logs. And, you know, Nixon does not want this to come out. And there's a moment in which he says, well, you know, we could try to get him out. But if we do, he's going to bring the whole temple down around him. And so Nixon, as well as Kennedy and others, were really very nervous about what was in Hoover's files. It's also worth saying that it doesn't really matter if you have the goods on people, as long as people think you might. That's the power, right? And so in some cases he does, in other cases he doesn't. But if you believe that he does, then you're going to do what he wants you to do.
It's true. Lyndon Johnson's analogy of micturation inside or outside the tent also comes to mind as well. You know, there's something very interesting to me about your book, which is that at the time you started it, the conservative movement was in no way similar to what it was post-Donald Trump. And you, of course, could not have envisioned Donald Trump's coming into existence. But there is now a national conservatism movement, which actually, I think at some point will seize upon Hoover as the kind of model government executive that they want, because these are people who believe that they have been shut out of every important aspect of American culture whether it be Hollywood, the media, academia, even large corporations and the military. And the only instrument that they have available to them to right the balance is the state, which they can use to smash their enemies, whether that's by confiscating Harvard's endowment or resorting to some of these extra-legal, extra-constitutional means that J. Edgar Hoover at various points in his career employed. And I wonder, you know, what lesson you might implore these national conservatives to take from your study of Hoover and his significance.
Well, I think, first of all, Hoover is a study in some of the dangers and downsides of having one man with unaccountable power. And I don't think we're in any danger specifically of having an FBI director who's going to be in office for 48 years again, right? I think that was very particular to a certain moment of state expansion. And we have a lot of other restrictions and such in place. So that scenario is not going to happen. One of the lessons of Hoover's life is that a set of techniques and ideas deployed in one space are very easily transferred over to other figures. COINTELPRO, right? The great story of COINTELPRO is something that starts out as a secret program aimed at the Communist Party in particular. Ultimately, because it is in many ways secret, mushrooms out to go after a vast array of other organizations and institutions. And so I think it is kind of a story about the danger of a secret bureaucracy. One of the things that's actually been interesting to me in this moment about the FBI's changing image and reputation is that when Hoover died, he and the FBI were much more popular among self-identified Republicans and conservatives than among Democrats and liberals. And that was true for the next four decades, really up until the Trump administration. But the thing that's happened over the last six or so years is that that has almost entirely flipped in public opinion polls. So Democrats now like the FBI much better than Republicans for some partisan reasons, one would imagine. But also, I think liberals have come to kind of recognize the value of a certain kind of professional fact-finding, nonpartisan aspect to the FBI that is still there and is pretty central to what the FBI does. And so that's been really interesting to watch. It's been interesting to see parts of the conservative movement, as Trump would define it, which maybe isn't really the conservative movement, but that's a different debate, attacking the deep state in ways that would be very familiar to kind of 60s and 70s radicals, right? And that would be shared by people on the left. So it's a little hard for me to say in this moment kind of what the reputational fate of the Bureau is going to be 5 years from now. Some of that will depend on what the Bureau itself does and then on what happens in electoral politics.
Well, Bev Gage, thank you so much for joining me today. Your magnificent new biography, G-Man, J. Edgar Hoover and the Making of the American Century, is just a real achievement and has given us so much to think about, both in the present and for how we regard our own American past. Thank you again.
Thanks, Jeff.
And thank you all for listening to the Vital Center podcast. Please subscribe and rate us on your preferred podcasting platform. And if you have any questions, comments, or other responses, please include them along with your rating or send us an email at contact@niskanencenter.org. Thanks as always to our technical director, Christy Eshelman, our sound engineer, Ray Ingenieri, and the Niskanen Center in Washington, D.C.